Good fences might make good neighbours, but perhaps no fences at all might make for better neighbourhoods. What do we talk about when we talk about co-housing? I don't think it's a stretch to say that we haven't quite hit upon the best way to live in our increasingly dense cities. We could better share resources, we could better work as communities. So many of our assumptions, it seems to me, about self-reliance and personal space are at odds with a sustainable, better, more productive future. But when faced with the reality of sharing a laundry with your neighbour or a living area or a utility bill, how might most of us cope? Does collaborative living live up to the ideal? Is closer-knit living a utopia, or is it your idea of a special kind of hell? The man who coined the phrase co-housing, Chuck Durrett, is in Australia for the first time. Chuck's a leading thinker, architect, and developer of sustainable communities in the US, and the author of a co-housing handbook called Creating Co-Housing, Building Sustainable Communities. Thanks for joining us, Chuck.
My pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
So help us out with the definition at the start. What exactly is co-housing?
Co-housing, by definition, is six elements, the four first ones being the key ones. First of all, the future residents, and most importantly, the future residents are part and parcel to the creation of the community. Typical development, banker, developer, bureaucrats, a partnership there. And we're simply inserting future residents as part of that. Of course, all of those other three parties get nervous that this might get too encumbered. The reality is, yes, it gets richer, no doubt, and infinitely more responsive. My experience, I've designed 50 co-housing communities myself with the future residents. And every time I do one, somebody says, oh, Chuck, why don't you know how to do this? Why don't you just do it? And I find that they bring real lives, real values, real experiences to the table to the point that they make them infinitely better than I could have myself. Second notion is that it is designed to facilitate a sense of neighborhood. So that's just for the benefit of the bureaucrats. Too often, always the co-housers want the cars off to the periphery or no cars at all. And the bureaucrats get threatened by that. So, and it's important for a child-friendly environment, for a senior-friendly environment, a walkable environment, even enhances bicycling and all the rest, is that there's often no cars or fewer cars. Third thing is that there's extensive common facilities. I live in a 34-unit co-housing community. I have a small house, but I have a 4,000-square-foot common house, which I share with my neighbors. So, in effect, if my house is 100 square meters, and the common house is 400 square meters, I really have a 500 square meter house in effect. But the advantages are that over at the common house, there's somebody else shopping, cooking, and cleaning up, and I do that once a month, and others do it numerous times in between, and we have dinner six nights a week. The fourth thing is that the property, the community, the village, if you will, is 100% self-managed, and that makes for usually by consensus, which means that people's private needs are protected, because if you feel like it at any point that this is going too far or anything else, you can not do it. But it's amazing to me, once you start using those common facilities, to what extent you feel like, so many things that we do individually now can be shared. We have one lawnmower for 34 households. It's more than enough. We have one big playroom in the common house for all the kids besides their small bedrooms. And it's so great. And, one swimming pool, for example. So there's so many things that you can share. And once you get into that mode, even if you didn't come to the table with a lot of that mentality from the beginning, you find that it's important. And the other two we've added, more recently, mostly to dispel of misconceptions, is that no, there's no hierarchy in decision making, and no, there's no shared income.
It's a wonderful set of ideals, and there's something very beguiling about it. But I think when we talk this morning, part of what I want to unpick with you is where practicality and ideals kind of collide. One of the bits of terminology I know you use about these is intentional community, which frankly sounds like something that Gwyneth Paltrow and Chris Martin might use to describe their relationship. But that intentional thing, that idea of defining the kind of place that you want to be in, seems pretty fundamental to it. Where does this thinking have its origins?
Well, basically in Denmark in 1972, groups of households got together and decided that, you know, the single family house as an aspiration didn't make sense. Let's aspire at least to make a custom neighborhood. In the U.S., I went to the University of Copenhagen, and in the U.S., I got motivated by walking by a community where I noticed every day people going to and from a building that nobody lived, everybody lived, and a life between the buildings that I did not see at the single family houses. I did not see it at the apartments, the strata, the senior housing. There was never any life between the buildings in a typical dwellings, and at best you would get a hello and a salutation like that. But in co-housing, I noticed every day that I walked by that there was life between the buildings. So one day I stopped, and this woman explained to me that her and her husband had grown up in very viable neighborhoods, and they wanted their children to have that. And at that moment, I noticed, I really felt like this is in fact a very conservative notion. A high functioning neighborhood is important building block to any society. A high functioning house, a high functioning neighborhood, a high functioning city. It's just part of that continuum. And yet we have skipped over the high functioning neighborhood to a large extent. So to the extent that we choose to do that, it's a very conservative notion. People really do get the wrong idea. Intention is only, the only intention is that, you know, we will give sharing the benefit of the doubt. That's the only common denominator I ever find amongst co-housers. Otherwise, there's no other common denominator that I could possibly share this or that, but and you can raise it, but we may not choose to do it. And but I will definitely, in doing so, I will definitely save time. I will save money. My life will be more convenient, more practical, more healthy, and more interesting and more fun by sharing than not.
That idea that there are as many things that divide the different approaches to co-housing as there are that unite them is an important one, I think. And before we go any further, I want to just listen to a conversation I got to have in an Australian model. It's not strictly speaking a co-housing community. It's Christie Walk in Adelaide. Describes itself as an eco-village, but it definitely takes its inspiration from the co-housing model. And I got down there a couple of weeks ago to talk to a couple of the residents.
Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you candy. Come on to my house,
I'm standing in Adelaide outside a place called Christie Walk. Christie Walk's an ecological housing hamlet in the heart of the city. There are 27 dwellings from apartments to individual homes, and the residents share space, chores, and utility bills. Just get your head around that, paying 1/27th of a water bill. The goal was to create a livable, affordable, and environmentally benign urban community. So I'm going to meet two of its residents, Sue Gilby and Josephine Thomas. Hello, good morning to you both.
Hello. Hi, Michael. Welcome to Christie Walk.
So what are the benefits for you of living in a place like this?
For me, it's about putting my money where my mouth is, basically. I've bought into the environmental credentials of living in Christie Walk, and the community was a bit of an added bonus that came with it.
Josephine, what about you?
I've been here for, I think, 12 years now, and I'm fortunate enough to live in a really attractive straw bale house, which I really love. And for something that quirky and that beautiful to be in the middle of the city, the feel that I get living right next to the community veggie patch is just amazing.
So we're starting off in your place, Sue?
Yes, I live in 55 square metres, and which is really quite small, but we don't need to have a laundry because we've got a shared laundry. And because I'm on the ground floor, I've got high ceilings. So actually in my spare bedroom, I've got a mezzanine bed.
55 square metres, it doesn't feel cramped at all. I've got to ask, sharing a laundry and being in close proximity with others, what makes a good co-housing neighbour?
Ultimately, respecting others is the important aspect. So you've got to read those signals. You've got to respect when Sue's having a grumpy day. I don't really want her to inflict it on me anyway, so I'm just going to keep away and check with her. But apart from having our own private spaces, we have the opportunity to share when we want.
How does that fit with the question of kind of community involvement and divvying up the responsibilities? There are times when you can't opt out, where you're needed to do stuff for the greater good.
We've never had a system of enforcing participation here, and I think that's key.
So we've walked through a kind of communal stairwell space and out into what once would have been a kind of driveway garage space. Let's walk along the side of Muriel and see what else we can find. Jo, what were the reactions you had from friends and family when you said you wanted to move into a kind of more community-focused eco-village, I think is the correct terminology?
Okay, so I'm really odd because my parents were here already and I decided I'd move closer to them. So the reactions from some people were, really, you want to be that close? This is my parents' straw bale cottage here, and they'd been here for a while before I moved in and they really liked the place.
So the straw bale houses and the freestanding structures have been explicitly built with an ecological outcome in mind and minimising their footprint?
Yeah, absolutely. Small footprint. So the whole development really comes out numerically as a high density, even though it's a low scale development. It's pretty impressive. And that's mainly because of the way shared spaces are cleverly used and you don't have your own parcel of land so cordoned off near your house. So you'll get the feel as you walk through that people have a little private space around their house. The houses all have really good kind of passive solar design, good ventilation to really maximise any of Adelaide's cooling breezes at night. And they've got a lot of those technologies like solar hot water, and now latterly they've been fitted with photovoltaic cells to make their own energy.
Walking through already, it's immediately apparent that there's a real disparity in design and style of the different residences in here. Does that mean that when it comes to divvying up responsibilities and cost, when it comes to a kind of share of utility bills, it's scaled based on the property that you're in?
The water comes out in the wash, so that is just purely split 27 ways. However, other stuff is done by a formal strata arrangement, which goes based on footprint. So it is fair according to the size of your dwelling. What might be considered unfair is that the voting entitlements that come with that don't actually have a sort of an equal status.
How have you seen those kind of decision-making processes and things change over the time and the life of Christy Walk?
Well, it evolves organically and naturally, as it should. And you'll never have a community of people where, you know, where it's utopia. It just doesn't work because people are people. But it has evolved and it's got to a stage where if people have an issue with something, they're quite able to raise it.
The main building is six stories high, five stories high?
Five stories. The main building is five stories high. And what we were talking about before in terms of sharing with our air conditioner, we all pay. So one person turns the air conditioner on and we all pay the costs of it. So it's not separately metered.
Does that lead to better behaviour, or is it like one of those Dutch auctions where everyone's waiting not to be the first person to turn it on a hot night?
It's the Dutch option. It's the Dutch option, definitely. Yeah. It does lead to better behaviour, and people are very conscious of the fact when they turn the air conditioner on that other people are contributing to paying toward it.
What's the makeup between owner-occupiers and renters?
I think that's about 30% of the total 27, out of the 27 that would be rented. And quite a few of the renters are much more active in the community.
You can see the bike shed over there to your right, Mark.
There's communal parking here, but then there's also a sizeable area for bikes.
There's only parking for, there's 11 car parks out of, for 27 households. So people car share?
It works quite well in that regard. Although I have to say the inequity of how you apportion 11 spaces to 27 dwellings can be a source of conflict, so we won't lie to you.
And no local planning challenges about having a space for 27 residences and not enough parking spots?
Definitely. So in the beginning, this was quite a point of contention. And so it had to be sold as part of the ecological credentials of the development. That battle was won successfully and I think has probably opened the way for future development to downsize their car space requirements.
Oh, these dwellings back here are gorgeous. So these are all straw?
That's a straw bale, and this one is a autoclaved aerated concrete, don't say that too quickly, apartment block. So this is our small apartment block, which is three stories high, six dwellings. Yeah, very nice. And it's got a rooftop garden, which you can come and have a look at as well.
Oh, this is pretty spectacular.
Yeah, so you get a pretty good view from up here. Nice place to come and watch fireworks when they're on. We grow a few things up here that are productive. So you can see a good crop of basil there, good crop of rosemary. It's a little bit too harsh for some of the stuff we've got up here. such as citrus, but with some of the screening plants that are starting to shelter it, they're coming along quite well. And we've got the beehive on the other side. So, the Joa tree there.
1/27th of a utility bill doesn't seem much if you're also getting 1/27th of a rooftop garden and homemade honey and everything else.
Yeah, I think the advantage of the sharing is some of these shared common spaces. They really make the place worthwhile. And knowing that you don't have to maintain them all yourself is really helpful. So even with the slightly haphazard voluntary contribution model, the things seem to puddle along quite well. So this is my larger version of a straw bale house.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
See why I thought this was an aesthetically pleasing house to own. I really like the look of straw bale. The way that the walls are so thick and quite organic in form, they have that adobe feel to them because they've got that thick layer of render over them, and then internally we whitewash them. We leave them that nice terracotta colour outside, but inside the whitewash just gives it a little more light feel.
So you're both here for the long haul. Can't imagine going back to living in civilian life outside the community.
No, I can't imagine living in the suburbs ever. And I can't imagine where I'd move to from here.
Both my partner and I don't want to go anywhere. He's definitely not moving.
Come on to my house.
I was talking to two of the residents from Christie Walk in Adelaide. Chuck Durrett, you came up with the term co-housing. How do you feel when you hear about and see projects that are inspired by it but deviate from the kind of core of co-housing as you mean it?
Well, certainly what we'll find across the world, actually, is lots of places are inspired by co-housing, and it's a bigger number than co-housing itself. I mean, co-housing, I don't contend that it presents a pure model per se. There's lots of deviation among co-housing communities themselves. But they have sort of set up a notion, as we adopted it from Denmark, where if you really want this to function at a very high level, this is how you accomplish it. And the great thing about so many eco-villages that I've worked on across the U.S. and Canada now, for example, is they very much build on the co-housing model, and many of them actually are co-housing too, as well as eco-villages. Because they find in particular that that's an extremely efficient way to make decisions. And that is, you know, these groups get together, and when, for example, you are co-developing a $5 million project, even though there's plenty of those projects that have folks in them who can't afford a lot, they figure out a way to accomplish it. And once you've accomplished that, and once you've together have gotten a project approved, even when you have, you know, parking disadvantages, etc. Once it's a huge threshold, and once groups get through that, they can accomplish just about anything. In addition, for example, where I live, I have to cook dinner once a month. It's a very high functioning co-housing, and fundamentally from the beginning, and you know, she was just announcing that they don't have any requirements. From the beginning, we felt like, you know, if I cook dinner for my neighbor once a month, if everybody cooks dinner for their neighbors once a month, they will maintain for many years to come a heightened sense of community. Every village in the history of our existence as a species has found nothing facilitates community like breaking bread together. And when it comes to the management of co-housing or any community, you know, people giving each other the benefit of the doubt, appreciating each other at a very fundamental level is the beginning of it, if not always the end.
Can I ask a slightly, just cut in with a slightly mundane question about the logistics of something like cooking for the collective once a month?
Yeah.
Is it a kiddie system? Do you have communal groceries? Are you just responsible that once a month? How do logistics like that work?
Well, I just want to finish by saying, once you've cooked dinner with everybody, for everybody, or they've cooked dinner for you, you give them the benefit of the doubt, and therefore the management gets easier. That's a watershed notion.
I don't want to get bogged down in the details. I understand what you're saying, but I guess for many of us, our experience of co-housing is goes back to things like share housing when at university, or and so those logistical things seem to me to somewhat predetermine the kind of people who take it up. In your experience, is it a particular age, a particular kind of lifestyle that gravitates towards these options?
Well, it's it's particularly, my experience is they're particularly responsible people. I sometimes call them the Uber responsibles. Because, you know, a lot of people like me, I have my own business. I don't want to be bogged down by shopping, cooking, and cleaning every day. And frankly, the people who make co-housing work are responsible people. They tend to be people who do, in fact, believe living on the planet a little lighter is easier if we share stuff. I mean, the fact that my lawnmower used to sit in the garage, you know, for 30 days a year just had made no sense, and we can amortize so much other costs. So the people would surprise you. In fact, I just finished a project in Oklahoma, USA, and it was over half Republicans, which was very unusual for co-housing. But they were people who fundamentally knew that their life would be better if they cooperated with their neighbor. That's all they had to know. And then sorting out the details after that become easier. And by the way, it's a lot easier than shared houses. I personally can't live in a, couldn't live in a shared house. You have to be careful. You know, of course, people will say anything. Oh, I love washing dishes, et cetera. And all of that is nonsense. What, you know, you just put down a few minimums. I also wrote another book called Happily Ever After in a Co-Housing. And that is the management minimums that makes it possible.
One of the things we heard in that story, and you kind of touched upon, was the collision between co-housing principles and the kind of context in which they happen, local planning laws, things like strata title. In your experience, how often does that collision make this kind of vision untenable?
Oh, well, not untenable. It makes it complicated and not difficult on many occasions, if not every occasion. The reality is, you know, zoning codes are done in an abstract for a generic default population and land use. And co-housers come to the table with a little vision. And by the time they start talking, 20, 30 people bring their ideas to the table. That vision becomes much more complicated and much more sophisticated than any planning department could ever hope to accomplish. So, for example, I just finished a project in downtown Vancouver, BC. And we wanted half the parking that the council wanted. But as soon as the group put on the table and agreed to have two shared electric cars, that would, and when you bought into that 31-unit project, these two shared electric cars come with your house, then the city said, great, put in half the parking places. So every single time we've asked for less parking, we have gotten it because the group can provide. And that's the other secret ingredient is using the future residents. If I don't have any secret future residents, I can't guarantee anything with the local municipalities. So
I hope the future residents live up to your vision of who they could be. It's certainly fascinating to hear about. Chuck Durrett's book is called Creating Co-Housing, Building Sustainable Communities in a Co-Housing Environment.